Welcome to this episode of the My Journey as a Physicist podcast. Each episode features an interview with a physicist to learn about their work, their interests outside of physics, and their professional journey of how they ended up where they are today. Season 2 features physicists involved in the particle physics planet community known as Snowmass. Hope you enjoy today's episode.
Welcome, Laura Bautis. Could you briefly introduce yourself? What is your current job?
Yes, so I'm Laura Bautis, and I am a professor in the physics department at the University of Zurich, and my specialty is experimental astroparticle physics.
Yeah, can you kind of go into detail of what some of your projects or like research interests are within that?
Yeah, my main big research interests are the nature of dark matter. I will talk a bit more about it, and the nature of neutrinos. So whether neutrinos are Majorana or Dirac particles. And then if we talk about dark matter, we already know that it's there, but we don't know what dark matter is made of. So we are trying to find out by a method that's called direct detection. The dark matter is made of new particles. That's what we think, but we have no proof yet. So new particles, of course, beyond the standard model, we are trying to look for these rare interactions of such dark matter particles with atomic nuclei or with electrons in our detectors. Yeah, in my case, in the case of my group and the collaboration I'm involved with, we are building large liquid xenon detectors to look for these interactions of dark matter particles with xenon nuclei. I don't know how far I should go, how far I should expand here.
Yeah. Can you maybe go into like a little more detail? I'm like kind of interested in how you like detect these particles. Like, is this some sort of collider? Are you gathering like cosmic rays, or like, how are you doing this?
Well, yes, you can imagine them as cosmic rays, in the sense that these particles are in the halo of our galaxy, of the Milky Way. And you can imagine them like collisionless gas. And together with our sun and with the Earth, we move in this halo, we move around the galactic center, and we feel this wind of dark matter particles. And very rarely such a particle would interact with you and me or with an atom in our detectors. And because of the cosmic rays, because of the radioactivity of the surroundings of the materials, we have to build these detectors deep underground. So the detectors need to be able to look for extremely rare collisions, right? So we look for collisions between these dark matter particles and the material of our detector. And they must also be able to measure very low energy depositions. So that scales with the mass of the particle. The lower the mass of the dark matter particle you want to probe, the lower your energy threshold needs to be. So at the same time, you need very large detectors, or you know, at least for most of the parameter space in terms of dark matter masses and cross sections, because we know we haven't found any. You know, I'm looking for about 20 years now for these dark matter particles. We haven't seen them yet, so we need to build larger and larger detectors, and also at the same time detectors that have lower and lower background noise, and yes, also low energy threshold. I personally, I work on detectors that are based on liquefied noble gases, in particularly liquid xenon. We started very small 15 years ago or so with tens of kilograms of detector masses of liquid xenon. And now we are operating in the Gran Sasso lab in Italy, a detector that's called Xenon N-ton and has a total of 8.6 tons of xenon. And we are also working towards the next generation of detectors that we call Darwin, that will have at least 50 tons of liquid xenon. And we look at the light and charge signals that are produced when particles interact with a liquid. On the one hand side, you produce scintillation light in around 175 nanometers wavelength. So you need very special photosensors to detect these signals. You also produce some electrons and you drift these. So we build what we call time projection chambers, TPCs. And those are two-phase TPCs. So we have the liquid phase and then a small, what we call gas gap or gas phase on top. So we drift these electrons into the liquid phase because we have to apply a drift field. So we have electrodes, we have field cages. Then we extract the electrons in the gas phase, where they then collide with other xenon atoms, and they produce what we call a secondary scintillation light. So we have a prompt scintillation signal, a secondary signal. And from these two signals, we can infer You know, the type of interaction, the position of an interaction, the energy that's deposited in the detector, and so on. The biggest issue is to select a potential dark matter signal from the remaining background, right? So you want to be able to suppress all possible background sources, right? Coming backgrounds from, you know, still existing radioactivity in your detector materials, from other isotopes that could be mixed with your xenon. In our case, that's radon-220. It's also a noble gas. Radon-222. Radon-220 we use for calibration purposes. It's krypton-85, potentially tritium and other things that can just get mixed with your liquid, produce radioactive decays. But ideally, those signatures that they produce should be different than the ones that could come from a dark matter particle. So we are now analyzing the data that we took so far with this 8.5-ton detector. And at the same time, we need still to do quite a lot of R&D design studies for this larger next generation detector, because all of the, you know, the difficult parts are always in the details, right? It's not so trivial just to make them bigger, to scale them up, especially because you need to preserve this low energy threshold on the one hand side, and also you need to further reduce the backgrounds, always at least by a factor of 10 or so. At some point, we will hit the neutrino background. So neutrinos are particles that interact very weakly, that will also, you know, they also go underground. This is also how they are detected, for instance, the solar neutrinos. But neutrinos we won't be able to suppress at some point. So, yes. So this is where we want to get into this region where we will hit these neutrino backgrounds with the next generation of detectors.
Yeah. And you said the detectors that you work on or work with now are in Italy. Is that right?
Right. So exactly. So all of dark matter detectors have to be in this. So direct detection dark matter detectors have to be underground. And in Italy, the Gran Sasso Laboratory, that's one of the largest underground labs in the world. It has a shield of about 1,400 meters of rock. We always convert this into how many meters of water it would correspond to, in order to compare different labs in the world. So it would be like 3,600 meter of water equivalent. It's not one of the deepest labs. One of the deepest labs is Snow Lab in Canada or Jinping in China, but it has quite some advantages because it has very large galleries. It has horizontal access. You can simply drive in. You can bring large pieces. So it's easier to build an experiment at this location. Yes. And we have a lot of infrastructure that we have already developed and installed, you know, for the previous generation of experiments in Gran Sasso. Yeah.
Yeah. And I imagine it's probably, there's a lot of considerations from like just the physics, as you said, in terms of like shielding and, you know, considering all these different gases and things like that. But then also just like physically located, like, okay, well, I can't build this, you know, massive underground thing in a giant city, right? Or, you know, other places like that. It seems like there's probably a lot of factors that have to like come into play.
Right. I mean, you have to have some underground location that's ideal. You have to have, you know, an actual lab that's running it, because there are a lot of safety requirements that you have to be aware of. And then, yes, as you say, just going underground and even selecting your materials for low radioactivity is not enough. We have pretty large shieldings. You know, we have this 8.5 tons of liquid xenon inside a cryostat. That's a double-walled cryostat. But then around this cryostat, we have a neutron. Well, we have a large water tank, let's put it that way. That's about 8 meters high, 9.6 meter diameter. And that water tank is equipped. It has a so-called muon veto. So it has a PMTs to detect the Cherenkov light that is created when muons pass the water. And so if they pass at the same time through your detector, so your xenon detector, and it's clear this was not a dark matter signal. And then we also have a neutron shield inside, you know, it's part of this water shield, because, you know, neutrons on the one hand side can be created by cosmic muons. So first of all, the cosmic muon rate in this Gran Sasso lab is suppressed by a factor of 1,000,000, but it's still a non-zero, right? So you still need to worry about it. And then these muons can then create neutrons, high energy neutrons. They lose energy, and at some point they can scatter inside your detector, and they can mimic a dark matter signal. So they can just collide with a xenon nucleus, and the interaction could look like a dark matter signal. So you'd like to suppress that. And that's why we also have a neutron veto. And neutrons can also be emitted from materials, because you have some remaining radioactivity, natural radioactivity, like uranium and thorium, you know, the decay chains. And there you have alphas that are emitted. And then you have alpha N reactions in materials. That's why from these alpha decays, you also get neutrons. And these neutrons, then again, let's say they are, can be emitted by your photomultipliers or your cryostat material and so on, they can scatter inside of your time projection chamber. However, if they scatter once in the time projection chamber and then they get out and scatter in the neutron veto that just surrounds the cryostat, then you can tag them. And again, you know, having these multiple interactions will tell you that it's not dark matter, because I should have mentioned that from dark matter particles, we expect that they would scatter only once in a given detector. Yes, the probability that they would interact multiple times, or, you know, in the xenon and in the water or neutron shield, that's just very, very low.
Yeah. What does collaboration in your group look like? Like, how big of a team is this?
Right. Yes. I mean, we have my group here. We are, you know, a bit less than 20 people in the group, the students, postdocs, senior scientists, technicians. But we are part of the Xenon collaboration. And there we have about 170 scientists from, you know, many universities, many institutions around the world. So from Europe, from the US, from Asia. And so we are an international collaboration that we all work together. Now we build a detector, but to operate it, to do the data analysis. And similarly, a bit larger collaboration where this Xenon collaboration is included, we have the Darwin collaboration where we do these R&D studies for the next generation. So we are not very large collaborations like you maybe know them from, you know, from high energy physics, where there are maybe 2,000, 3,000 people. So we are quite a bit smaller. We are still below 200 people, so we know each other. Personally, I would say all of the members of the collaboration have quite an important role. Also, the students have, they are very visible, they have a lot to say. So it's still a size that I think it's quite nice to be working in, yes.
And then can you describe your involvement with the SNOMAS group?
Yes. So as you know, in SNOMAS, there are all these different frontiers, and I'm interested, of course, in the neutrino frontier. We didn't talk about that, but it's another field of research, and the cosmic frontier where the, you know, dark matter is included, but there is also this underground frontier, and I'm one of the co-conveners there. So there we are trying together with the other three co-conveners, we are looking at all the available underground laboratories around the world. We are just doing a survey in terms of what they have to offer on the one hand side, in terms of the facilities, you know, and not just the underground space, but everything else, all the other support that you need in such an underground lab that they can offer. And at the same time, we are also looking at the experimental requirements, you know, over the next decade, you know, what will the next generation experiments need? Not only in dark matter, but also in all the other fields, in neutrino physics, in also gravitational wave physics, and so on. And then, you know, you'd like to see whether the expectations from the experiments actually match what the current labs or you know, even future developments for these labs will be able to offer. So yes, this is where I'm mainly involved in this SNOMAS process. Exactly. Yeah. And you know, we have of course in our underground facilities frontier, then we have the subtopics where we have exactly this, you know, the dark matter experiments, the neutrino-less double beta decay experiments, and so on. And then we are also discussing this so-called synergistic activities. So other fields that are benefiting from such, you know, underground laboratories.
Yeah. And what has your involvement in SNOMAS like kind of meant to you?
It's for me, I mean, even though of course I'm in Europe, right? It's a very important process because, you know, it will define it now in my case, you know, speaking of this next generation dark matter detector and, you know, similarly actually for the double beta decay, but let's stay with the dark matter. You know, I mentioned our collaboration, our efforts, but there is a competing effort in the US that's called Lux Zeppelin. And, you know, they're about at the same level that we are with Xenon Anton. However, within Xenon and also the Darwin project and LZ, we are now getting together. We are discussing, we actually signed an MOU last year to build a much larger global collaboration to build this next generation of detector, right? And whether the US, the DOE, will support such what they call a generation 3 Xenon dark matter experiment depends also on the outcome of snow mass, and especially then on the decisions that will be recommended, well, on the recommendations, not decisions, from P5, right? So for me personally, it's a very important process, because of course I am very much in favor that we can build such an experiment together with our, you know, colleagues from the US. I mean, some of our existing colleagues in Xenor are in the US, but there's a much, much larger effort there that, as I said, right now we are competing, but it's very, you know, it's a very good start to discuss and to work actually together with your competitors towards, you know, building something together in the future. And actually next month, when in June, we'll have a common in-person meeting in Germany, all of us. So yes. But, you know, we don't, you know, we do all these studies, we do the R&D and so on, but that doesn't mean that we have the funding to build this kind of detector. And that's where SNOMAS comes in. And also, I like the fact that it's a very, you know, bottom-up approach, right? That comes from the community, what we think we want to do in the future, what is important. I mean, there are many, many other aspects, of course. I'm just focusing now on this xenon detector. But yeah, so what do we want? And then hopefully the recommendations will reflect also the wishes of the community.
Yeah, no, that's really interesting, especially, you know, as you said, it's like SNOMAS was primarily in the United States, but this is definitely like more of an international sort of effort.
Exactly. I think it affects us all. Absolutely. Absolutely. Yes.
So I'm just kind of curious, going back, like, what got you interested in physics in the first place?
That's a good question. So, well, I came to physics through math, actually, in school. Even in high school, I was mostly interested in math and in computer science. And, you know, for a long time, I didn't actually consider to study physics, but somehow, yeah, I wanted either to study math or computer science. And then in the last year of high school, we had a bit of modern physics, you know, what you would call now the very early stages of quantum mechanics and so on. That really got me more interested in physics. And then I realized, maybe I can use, you know, the fact that I like math so much, and also informatics, computer science, but, you know, study something that's more applied, in the sense that it has more to do with the real world, with how things work. So yeah, so rather sudden, I decided that I'd like to study physics. So I studied physics in Heidelberg, and then, you know, I had to select a minor. And then my first minor was philosophy, but already after a semester, I decided maybe something else, even though I like philosophy and I still read a lot. But I then took astronomy as a minor, yeah, astronomy, astrophysics, which of course is closely related to physics. So it was also kind of easy. And then yes, towards the end of my, you know, what we now call master's, back then it was diploma, I got interested in this dark matter problem, but also in this other question on neutrino physics. And
yeah, so like, what about like the dark matter and neutrino physics like stands out to you of like as more interesting than maybe the other field?
So dark matter, you know, it was more also this field of astroparticle physics. So especially dark matter and direct detection, when I was an undergraduate, and then, which was, you know, in the late 90s, we were pretty much at the beginning of the field, in the sense of, you know, building detectors where we would hope that we can actually find something. So these were really small tabletop experiments. So I was interested in the question, in, you know, what is the dark matter made of, but also in the fact that, you know, as a student, I could build more or less my own experiment and learn everything about it, you know, do the Monte Carlo simulations, do the data analysis, but also, you know, install the detector, install the electronics. So because I also considered other topics more in high energy physics. I was fascinated by CERN. We had a visit to CERN when I was an undergraduate. So that was really, I was very, very impressed by that. But in the end, I think I was mostly attracted to the fact that these were still very small experiments where you could make a big impact, right? As I said, now we are much bigger. We are not that big, but clearly we had to go to larger projects and also to larger collaborations. And yes, why dark matter? Probably because I had, you know, I had some lectures as an undergraduate where we had, you know, where this problem was presented. And I just found it fascinating. The fact that we, you know, back then we didn't even know that much as we know today about its, you know, density, local density distribution and so on. So there were even more open questions, even from the cosmology and astrophysics side than now, right? Now, many of those questions that were then still open were answered, even though not all, but you know, we still don't know what it is, what it's made of, right? So we know much more about its what the dark matter density is, what is its overall distributions on larger scales, on galactic scales, and so on, even though not all of the details. So this is something that I think fascinated me back then, but and it's still, you know, something that keeps me excited when building out this new scale of experiments, exactly.
Yeah. And so through your kind of career and journey as a physicist, if you feel comfortable sharing, like, were there any obstacles like along the way in your career that you had to like overcome?
Yes, sure. I mean, of course, back then we were, you know, not so many women in physics when I studied physics, maybe only a few, right? And some of the professors were a bit, they say, oh, that's the girl's corner, or, oh, you know, can you actually do this? Or so they were a bit, I mean, I wouldn't say the majority, but some of our professors would make remarks as, you know, to me or even to some colleagues that were, you know, thinking now about it or even later, maybe not totally appropriate, right? So this was sometimes a bit strange. Even I had my first child, who's now a master's student in physics, but when I was a PhD student, and, you know, then a pretty famous physicist and was also Max Planck director told me, oh, I should stay home, right? Because I should stay home for a few years with my child because my child needs this and so on, which I thought, you know, was totally nonsense, right? I think the situation, but yeah, you know, these were maybe compared to probably what others have been going through were not like big obstacles because I was also very determined and I didn't take, yeah, this sort of remarks or so serious or too seriously, let's say. Right. Then there are these sometimes there are these 2-3 body and so on problems. So my husband and I were both in science, and then we had to look, of course, around when we went for postdocs to places where we can both get a position and work on the research topics that we wanted to be involved with. So in that sense, we were also a bit lucky because we both had offers at Stanford after Heidelberg. So we moved there. But then, you know, the question is, what do you do afterwards? So then you have to just be ready to compromise somehow. You know, where do you go as a postdoc? Where do you go later on, apply for faculty positions and so on? You always have to be somehow aware that there must be a possibility that both of you should get good offers or offers where at least you're happy with the environment, with the work that you do. Yeah, I don't think I had many, other like big obstacles, actually. You know, it's something that, so of course, these issues in physics, of course, in natural sciences in general, of gender, minority. So it's something that I thought a lot about also during my career and here. And I always strive to achieve a good balance in my group. And I think that's having a diverse group, I think that's very good, very healthy for everybody. It's also just better for our research and also for the environment in which we work. So this is something that I try to pay a lot of attention to, of course. Yes.
Yeah. Well, thank you for sharing that. I'm kind of curious, you know, spent all this time doing physics, you know, all this great work. I'm kind of curious, like, what do you do as a break outside of work? Is it just physics all the time, or like, what do you do for fun or for hobbies?
Right. Yeah. Well, you know, it's physics a lot of the time. But yeah, I still need sometimes to get away from physics. So, you know, being in Switzerland, I like to hike a lot. And this is also because then you're just outside in nature and, you know, you can still think about physics or other things, but at least, you know, you're not in front of your computer. I also like kayaking here, mostly on lakes, because we have all, even in Zurich, we have Lake Zurich, and then you have all these other lakes. You know, most of them are really great for kayaking, so hiking, kayaking. And then apart from that, I like to read, you know, not just physics books, but lyrics, novels. Also, I like to read a lot of, you know, apart from fiction, I like to read nonfiction, but not in my field, like in life sciences or geography or so, just because I'm interested, you know, in these other fields. And of course, I don't know a lot about them, genetics, for example. And it's just fascinating to me how much, you know, how complex everything else is apart from physics. So physics seems to me like the easiest subject somehow. And if you go away from everything else, it's just so more, much more complicated and complex, right? Especially in life sciences. Yes, then of course, now my children are a bit older. So, you know, they still live with us, which is nice. But when they were younger, you know, of course, they are like my biggest hobby because I spend a lot of time and was trying to spend as much time as I can with them and just to do things together, right? Just to, yeah. Hike together, kayak together, read together, and so on. I also like, you know, in Zurich, you have a lot of, it's not by US standards, it's not such a big city, but it has a lot of to offer in terms of cultural events, you know, concerts, theaters, museums, and so on. So there's a rich cultural life here. And as much as I can, I try to profit from it. So yeah, this is what I mostly do in terms of relaxing, getting away from physics. Yeah, for brief amounts of time, because yes.
Yeah, those all sound super fun. Sort of like wrapping things up a little bit here, I'd like to ask people if you have like any advice for students or young researchers kind of starting, you know, in their early career phases in their physics careers.
Yeah. Well, yes, I mean, maybe the main advice is, of course, you know, to pick something, to select something that they really like, that they enjoy to do, and also to stick with it, and maybe not, of course, you know, everybody says you need to work hard, you need to be flexible, all of that. But I think it's really important that you find something that you really enjoy. And also everybody, when you're at this stage, I remember everybody tries to give you advice and sometimes it's a bit confusing, right? And, you know, for me, some of my professors were telling me, oh, you're good enough to be a theorist. Others professors were telling me, oh, if you don't do some experimental physics, you will never be a physicist, like a real physicist. So, and then, you know, this can be really confusing because, so it's, I think it's really important to find out what you really want and what you like. And it's not so easy because there are many, you know, many in physics, right? There are many topics, many subjects that seem fascinating. And that's why I think it's also good to look a bit around, maybe, I don't know, you know, here we do, the students, they can do some internships and they do a bachelor thesis where they spend some time working on a topic in the lab or otherwise, like a few months. Then you can do, you know, the semester projects. Then you do the master project where, again, you spend, let's say, 6 months on a topic. And what I find good is that you can just switch totally between fields during these topics. And then you have such a better view, I think, of what you want to do when you go on to do a PhD or so, right? You know, do you want to stay in particle physics or astroparticle or condensed matter or you know, many all these other fields. So maybe this is my main advice to find something, to look a bit around and then find something that you're really fascinated by, because then, you know, also the what we do then doesn't seem so hard, right? If you really like the topic.
Yeah, for sure. Thank you for sharing. I think that's really good advice. And thank you for sharing your experiences in physics and, you know, a little bit about your research. It was great talking with you.
Yeah, thanks a lot. Also, it was really fun. And thanks for all the good questions.
We hope you enjoyed today's episode. This podcast was created by Brian Stanley and Professor Wei-Wen Lin. Season 2 was edited by Varley Sakorikar. Thank you for listening.